Hi FM, 101.9 megahertz of life.
The Israel Report brought to you with the compliments of the Blue Agency, Israeli Property Management and Sales.
The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, it's been way too long. How are you?
Boker Tov, welcome back.
Thank
nice
you very much.
Talk to you again. And if we're already talking about the Champions League, let's talk about the Champions League in Israel, because, of course, Paris Saint-Germain, PSG, are in Haifa to play a group game against Maccabi Haifa this evening. And along with PSG come some of their hero players, Kylian Mbappe, Neymar, Brazilian wonder kid, and, of course, the Argentinian demigod, Lionel Messi, who are all here to play this evening against Maccabi Haifa. Now, Messi has been in Israel before, and there are the famous pictures of him at the Kotel, but he's never been in Israel to play a competitive game. So this is the first time that he, together with Paris Saint-Germain, are here to play a competitive game against Maccabi Haifa. They will play at the Sami Ofer Stadium this evening in Haifa. It promises to be a very, very fascinating game. I'm told that tickets have been changing hands for something like 1,500 shekels and more.
Lots and lots of interest
in that particular game. Just something else that I thought might capture your imagination, seeing as kids have gone back to school now. There's been a survey released about children losing house keys in Israel. Apparently, that is a real problem. One of the big lock companies did a survey where they interviewed children and parents, children between the ages of 7 and 18, about losing house keys and how they've lost their house key. Now, I remember when my kids first went into first grade in Israel, one of the discussions that the teacher always holds with the parents is about where their children keep their house keys, because from the age of 6, children in Israel go around with a house key. They let themselves in and out. There are many, many children who come home from school, even at the age of 6, 7, 8 years old, come home from school to an empty house or to a house that is only with children after school. Parents are at work until the parents come home. The children are effectively home alone, and children need to be allowed to let themselves into their houses. And so we were always instructed that the best place to keep the house key is to keep it on a long piece of string, which is tied to the inside of the school bag somehow, so that children can take it out of the school bag while it's on the string, open the front door, and then put it back in. The problem, of course, is that if you lose your school bag, if your school bag gets stolen, not only do they have the house key, but they inevitably have identification as to where you live, because somewhere in the school bag might well be an address. So that's obviously a bit of a problem. We are told that 1.4% of the keys that are lost are stolen along with school bags, and that something like another 1% of the keys are actually lost along with the school bag. So that's according to this. And 13.7% of the cases, the key actually fell out of the school bag or out of their pockets. So apparently the answer to this particular question comes in the form of smart locks. These days you can get a lock that doesn't need a key. It needs a fingerprint or a code or a remote control or a smartphone app. And apparently that is the answer. And I'm told that sales of these smart door locking systems have increased by 60% in recent months.
Very interesting. Obviously just a specific problem to not a problem or a challenge around a society where people work, but where kids have a lot of independence. Two terrorists were killed in a gunfight with IDF troops in north of Israel overnight. Has there been more information released around this?
There has been more information released, Howard, and unfortunately the more information involves the death of an IDF officer as well, involved in this exchange of fire with two armed Palestinian gunmen, which was near the village of Jalma, which is north of the city of Jenin. So unfortunately, not only those two terrorists, but indeed now news about the death of an IDF officer. We're told that this incident began at around 11:30 last night when IDF observation forces noticed two suspects who were approaching the security fence along the seam line near a military post. We understand that there was an attempt to try to arrest these two individuals, but in the process of doing so, a gunfight broke out between those two people and IDF troops, and the two individuals concerned were killed. We are now told that an IDF officer also has been killed in that particular gunfight. So very, very sad news indeed. And we don't know any more about that at the moment, but we are waiting to hear a little bit more about exactly what this involved, who the officer was, and what more details we know about this event. We are told that the two individuals may well have been already involved in an incident last week where there was an attack mounted against engineering forces of the IDF. There is a suspicion that these two were the same, or at least part of that same group of individuals who were involved in that attack. And it comes ahead of an assessment that was done together with Prime Minister Yair Lapid and along with security services about our current state of security as we head into the High Holy Days. Of course, a very, very short time now until Rosh Hashanah is upon us. And in that security assessment, the Prime Minister was told that there are at least 70 current concrete known plans of terror attacks that are intended to be carried out over the High Holy Days. So obviously the security levels are being increased quite substantially over the Chagim season, over what they now like to call the Tishrei holiday season. And of course it becomes a little bit of a focus because not only do terrorists like to carry out attacks over holiday periods when they know that people are with their families and potentially crowded in together, perhaps people going to shuls or people going outdoors, taking advantage of the holiday period, but also because they know that many of the IDF soldiers like to go home to spend holiday time with their families. And of course, there will be soldiers who will have the opportunity to go home and spend holiday time with their family. And there is a perception that there may be some weakness in the security system as a result of soldiers being sent home for the holidays. Mm. That perception is entirely false, and there will be a very, very high level of security maintained over the holiday period. Many of our soldiers will remain on duty in their bases, doing whatever they ought to be doing in order to protect Israel over the Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and Sukkot period. And there will certainly be very, very high levels of security indeed. But a noticeable increase, I should say, in the extent to which there are terror threats and security threats in Israel over the past few months. I don't think that, I can't say for myself that I feel the threat when I go about my daily business in the way that you described when you were in Jerusalem and you felt that there was this kind of constant security situation around you. I don't think that I feel that now, and I'm not quite sure that other people even in Jerusalem might feel it, but certainly
well, it was
on the borders,
a very specific time during Ramadan and where there was this build-up of a lot of tension at the time.
That's true. But I think we're being told that we shouldn't be fooled into a false sense of security because there's a lot of activity going on. And even, you know, the outgoing IDF chief of general staff, Aviv Kochavi, spoke about the situation on the northern border. And he said we shouldn't be fooled into believing that everything is quiet and everything is good because there is really a lot of threat that the IDF perceives, not only along the northern border, but indeed elsewhere around Israel.
Israeli interns have agreed to withdraw their threat to resign after an agreement was reached to reduce the length of their shifts. So what are the details of this agreement?
So the Prime Minister had to be personally involved in brokering this agreement with Israeli medical interns in order to reduce the length of time that they're expected to spend on shift. And the length of time of an average shift for these interns has now been reduced, I'm told, to 16 hours. Sorry, to 18 hours from what was originally 26 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
Now, I can't imagine how anybody could do a shift of 26 hours, never mind a medical person, and be expected to actually function normally under those circumstances. The thing that surprises me the most about this agreement which has been reached involving the Prime Minister, and in terms of which hospitals will be given more money. The hospitals who agree to shorten the shifts for these interns will be actually given more money, and an amount of 66 million shekels has been set aside to transfer to these hospitals who are willing to shorten the shifts. But here are some of the surprising things, at least that I find surprising. The first of which is that the Israel Medical Association, which represents doctors, medical people around Israel, and admittedly, in the most part, represents veteran medical physicians rather than the interns that we're talking about. The Israel Medical Association has come out opposing this deal. They think that this is not a good idea to reduce internships from 26 hours to 18 hours. Now, I can't imagine why they would think that. But in fact, it has been mentioned that one of the reasons why there has been opposition to this agreement is because there's a simple shortage of personnel. And so to the extent that shifts are shortened, there are just not enough people to come in and to fill the gaps that are now being left as a result of the shifts being shortened. And this is very, very surprising to me, because I know how difficult it is for Israeli students who wish to study medicine to get into medical school. Very, very high quality individuals who would love to be doctors and who would love to study medicine in Israel are being turned away because there are not enough spaces in medical schools around Israel. And so obviously this would be an answer to get more doctors qualified in order to fill the gaps. Now, of course, that's not an answer for today, for this month, and even for this year. But apparently, and there's a lot of opposition simply because there just aren't the people available to fill these gaps. So I don't exactly know what the plan is of those hospitals, even if they get extra money, what they plan to do other than potentially try and attract doctors to come and work in Israel from abroad. But this is a very, very significant issue. And one of the other sort of related issues to this is that apparently the hospitals that are out in the peripheral areas outside of the central part of Israel are suffering more than hospitals in the central part of Israel. And so one of the opposition groups has come out saying that Yair Lapid has done a bad job of giving money to hospitals which are in the central part of Israel, when in fact this is really more required for the hospitals who are in the periphery in order to try to attract good quality doctors to be willing to go to those outlying areas and work in the hospitals there rather than to be focused in the central part of Israel.
Charles says, my son is at Barra. Sometimes he does 30-hour shifts. So it's not...
astonishing.
It is astonishing. I don't know how they can be expected to give the right level of care. It's impossible. Absolutely.
Astonishing.
It's bizarre. Israel is set to provide Europe with natural gas to replace up to 10% of its supply from Russia. This is absolutely incredible. What's the timing on it, though?
So I did speak yesterday with Chad about the visit by Prime Minister Yair Lapid to Germany, where he spent 24 hours. And it was a very emotional visit because he also visited the Wannsee Villa, which is where the final solution was drafted up by Heydrich at the time, the SS officer Heydrich, who was in charge of that. Ironically, Heydrich was bullied as a child. One of the reasons why he was bullied as a child was because it was claimed that he had Jewish ancestry, and he was the one who ultimately drafted up the final solution. Just a very fascinating side point to make.
I didn't know that.
And while Prime Minister Yair Lapid was in Germany, he also spoke about the sale of the Arrows anti-ballistic missile system to Germany, which is very much in favor of. And I forgot to mention the fact that he spoke about gas, because, of course, with the current issue that is being experienced between European countries and Russia on the issue of the war in Ukraine, and the matter of Russian gas and Russian oil has very much come to the forefront. because Russia has been using its gas supply as a lever to try to convince European countries to stay out of the matter of the war in Ukraine. And by the same token, European countries, while boycotting almost every aspect of Russia that they can possibly boycott, are unable to boycott the purchase of Russian gas, because it would simply bring European industry to a halt. And more than that, as we now move into the Northern Hemisphere winter, Russian gas is used to heat many European households across the European continent. So in order to be able to be more loyal to the boycott that Europe wishes to undertake against Russia, it also needs to somehow boycott Russian gas. That would be very much more damaging to the Russian economy, and would also represent a very significant signal to Russia about what Europe is thinking on the issue of the war in Ukraine. But of course, without an alternative supply of gas, Europe is very much held over the barrel, and you'll pardon the pun, because of their reliance upon Russian gas. So Israel comes in as a Johnny come lately in the world of natural gas, having discovered a number of natural gas fields off the coast of Israel, and is now apparently negotiating not only with Germany, but indeed with other European countries as well, to supply from Israel's natural gas fields up to 10% of the supply that was previously being bought from Russia. Mm. Now, it might not sound like a lot. 10% is just small slice. Yeah. But it's a significant amount of gas. And for a small country like Israel, whose gas supply is relatively undeveloped and still being developed, we are just about to turn on the gas supply from the Karish gas field, which is on the Lebanese border. That gas is due to flow within the next few weeks. So this is a very, very significant moment and a very significant agreement with the Europeans in order to be able to supply gas to Europe. We understand that from the income that Israel has gained from the sale of natural gas around the world, the sovereign wealth fund that has been established by Israel in order to deposit the profits from gas supply, or the taxes that are being extracted from the gas supply, has already reached something like 2 billion shekels and is growing. So we're looking forward to, of course, that wealth fund growing even further, and a lot more gas being supplied to Europe and to others who are all very willing and interested in buying gas from Israel.
We don't have a lot of time, but the financial impact, the impact on the economy, on the Israeli economy?
Well, the financial impact on the Israeli economy has been significant, because it goes right from the ground up. First of all, many, many jobs being created on the gas platforms and within the gas industry in general. Of course, some of Israel's largest companies have partnered with international gas extractors, companies in the gas extraction world, to bring the platforms here and to extract the gas. So presence of international companies in Israel as a result of the supply. And of course, the government is taking its fair share off the top of a tax that's being levied upon that industry in order to finance the sovereign wealth fund that's been created, which will, in the fullness of time, help to finance social payments to irregular Israeli citizens, similar to the way in which, for example, Norway has used the income from its gas in order to provide social benefits to citizens. So all in all, this is a very, very significant improvement and development in the Israeli economy.
Anthony Rach, thank you as always. We'll catch you tomorrow at the same time. That was the Israel Report, and the Israel Report brought to you with the compliments of the Blue Agency, Israeli Property Management and Sales. It's 8 o'clock.